Welcome to Our Hen House. This is Jasmine Singer.
And this is Marianne Sullivan.
Happy New Year, and thank you so much for joining us this week. Marianne will be speaking with Rebecca Jenkins about the animals who are still the most underappreciated and casually mistreated animals in the world. I am, of course, talking about fish and other aquatic animals. Rebecca is the executive director of the Aquatic Life Institute and is working hard to improve the lives of these animals.
On this week's Flock Bonus segment, I'll be continuing my really fascinating conversation with Becky. As always, if you are a Flock member, you will get a link to that bonus segment in your email on the Tuesday after this podcast goes up. You can always find it on the Flock Facebook group if you don't get to see it in your email. And if you're not a member of the Flock, you can and you can afford it, you can join for $10 a month at ourhenhouse.org/donate. And speaking of donations.
Yes, I just want to offer a very big thank you to those of you out there who helped us to reach our goal this year of raising $20,000 from you, our listeners, which was matched by our Barnyard Benefactors, equaling 40, which was matched also by an anonymous donor. So we had a really important end of year fundraising this past year, 2020. We reached it. Thank you to you and your generosity. And just so you know, we do the vast majority of our fundraising at the end of the year. So even though it sounds like a lot of money, it's like most of our budget for the year to have all of the technicians and the producers and the people who help us with the Our Hen House podcast as a whole. So from all of us at Our Hen House, thank you for believing in the power and purpose of independent vegan media that is pro-animal and women-run and LGBTQ-founded. We really appreciate you so much. So it is a new year, and we do have a very sad announcement, and then we're going to very quickly move past it because we don't want to dwell there for multiple reasons.
Yeah, I just wanted, for those of you who did not see it on social media, to let you know that our beloved dog, Rose. Rose has been with me for 15 years and was with Jasmine for many years as well. And we both loved her very, very much, as you may know when we've spoken of her. And she passed this past week, and it's been a very hard time. And thank you for all of your well wishes. Yeah, we're not going to talk about it anymore because I can't.
Okay. That is fine. Okay, well, in the interest of the new year, we have been discussing how to sort of position this first episode of the year. This is our 12th year. We started in January of 2010. So it's our 12th year, or another way of putting it is it's our 11 year anniversary of having our hen house, of going up on the air every single month for the past 11 years. So, wow, a lot has certainly changed in that time, including the world. The world is like 100 years older than it was just 1 year ago. But here we are, and we're not going to get like too hung up on the intention setting. But if you can like just sort of pander to my woo side for just a few minutes, then I would appreciate it. Because I am currently, as I record this, giving thought to like, what does 2021 look like? And obviously, we can't predict it too much because I have so many stories of people telling me that they were doing this last year and like looking at what 2020 would look like. And then the world went to hell, and I don't want to make any big predictions or anything like that. But I do want to get clear on what I can do as my role in changing the world for animals, and also just being a longtime activist and how I can take care of my own animal rights. So I would like to come up with new ways to help people go vegan. I had my second book come out just a few weeks ago, The Veg News Guide to Being a Fabulous Vegan. And it's really opened up for me some thoughts on the importance of having that one-on-one stuff out there. A lot of what I do is pour myself into like this animal activist-centered sort of mindset and media creation. But I also really want to make sure that we are creating places for people to go vegan. So that is a big general statement, but I'm looking into new ways of doing that. I'm feeling very motivated and emboldened by the warm reception of Fabulous Vegan. So thank you for that. And on a personal level, I would like to chill out more. I don't know if I could accomplish it. How are you doing on that realm?
You know, I've kind of given up on that. I mean, I think I've probably made that resolution. I don't really make New Year's resolutions anymore because, you know, and I think sometimes New Year's resolutions are a problem because, you know, people make them, then they break them, and then they don't go back. And I want people, more and more people, to go vegan every single day. That's the only New Year's resolution I'm interested in, at least for other people. And not for you guys, of course, because you're already there. But, you know, I want them to do it every day. I don't want them to do it just on January 1st and then have it not. I mean, I didn't go vegan all in one fell swoop. So
one swell swoop.
But I got off the topic. Yeah, chilling out. Not my area of expertise. Right. And it's not that I'm always accomplishing things. When I look at what so many activists that we talk to accomplish, like, I'm just embarrassed. Like,
that's so
they
silly.
Do so much. But it's not, so I'm not saying I'm constantly working. I just, you know, I'm constantly just either doing something or anxious about doing something. I think that is my lot in life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'll try.
Well, that's, yes. Okay. Well, I will let you know if I come up with any great systems of doing so. But one way is that I'm constantly trying to reassess those toxic relationships and patterns in my life and let them go and make space for new healthy habits and healthy people and safe spaces. And so that is something I'm in the midst of doing right now, which I feel really good about.
I mean, I would like to do that, but I hate to be the dark voice in this little episode, but don't you feel like 2020 has made you feel like virtually everybody is toxic?
Right.
Like, I'm just so shocked at how much I have found out. And we're vegan animal rights activists, so we know that people are screwed up in very serious ways, but wow.
I definitely know what you mean. I mean, there's certainly a darkness that I was maybe not unaware of, but certainly not honed in on that 2020 brought to light.
They're just worse than we thought.
Well, but on a personal level, I do feel like even now I'm like, you know, making new connections and sort of recognizing that I don't need to hold on to some other ones. And just like, I think we owe it to ourselves to go through this life in pursuit of our more evolved self. And so that is something I have tried really hard to work on, and I will continue to. And that feels good. That feels like, okay, it is not easy. Sometimes you need to cut ties with people. Sometimes you need to like make radical shifts in your life. But once you do it, like usually, even if it's painful, it gets you to a better place. And then you can show up more as an activist.
Yeah, I just want to revisit my dark, dark statement and say that the fact that so many people have disappointed me in spite of my low expectations this year, I don't feel that's hopeless. I really feel that if there's one thing that this year has shown, it's that leadership matters. I know I talked about this a few weeks ago in the podcast. I feel like I'm going to talk about it every week. Leadership matters desperately. And I mean, we've seen that in everything that has happened this year, that people follow. And that means that every single one of us, introverts included, I mean, I'm talking to myself there, have to step up and have to lead. You know, apparently people can't figure things out for themselves. Yeah. So we've got it figured out. We're right about everything. We have to let people know.
Okay, not quite that. But you could get Fabulous Vegan for people and hand that to them. So, but I do agree.
You're just saying that, but that is really true. Fabulous Vegan is a really remarkable, I know it's our podcast and it's Jasmine's book and all of that, but seriously, it's being touted to some extent as a cookbook and it has fabulous recipes in it, but it is the book on getting people to read about why they should go vegan, but in a way that is not going to make them defensive. It's light. And I know that's hard to believe. It's hard to make this stuff light. But Jasmine's been working on this, that philosophy for a long time, and she really honed it in this book. It's really a valuable tool.
Thank you very much for that. We also have another book coming out this year that I was the editor of. You might have been following the Encompass essays this past year, which was a collaboration between our hen house and Encompass and Sentient Media. We have a book coming out in just a few months, published by Lantern Media, called Anti-Racism and Animal Advocacy. So that's something I'm really excited about this year. And I would love to sell another book. So I'm working on some proposals right now, and just maybe with that idea of like self-care, like radical self-care, and, you know, going vegan as sort of the main themes that are popping up for me. So hopefully if you're out there, you also have some thoughts that you've been putting together for how you want to use this sort of hard line in the sand of 2021 to reassess where you're at. And if there are things you've always wanted to be doing, start to think about how you can make them a reality. They aren't going to just happen. So if you have dreams of moving to that place or like starting that new business or whatever, just create a timeline for yourself for this year and maybe even put it in your calendar if that's the kind of person you are, like a campaign plan. I remember when I worked for Farm Sanctuary like 100 years ago and I learned how to write a campaign plan, like that has actually really stuck with me as a personal thing too. We can write our own campaign plans and like, what is the outcome? If you start with the outcome and you go backwards from there, then you can build a campaign to set yourself up for success.
I really do think this year, in spite of like all of the negativity, has enormous potential. Like for the first time that I can really remember, the meat industry has really hit the headlines. I know not the way it, or as much as we wanted them to or that they should. And I know people are still, you know, really not paying attention to what's happening to the animals as much as they should. But they have remained so hidden for so long. And, you know, we've been crying in the wilderness. And this year, you know, they started getting some news and they responded to the pandemic in horrific ways. Slaughterhouses, or as I like to call them, meat plants, have been the center of infection. And that really brought them into the spotlight. They got some seriously bad press, not nearly as bad as they should have. They are not down, that's for sure. Sales have not really gone down and people are still buying this stuff. But they are vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And now is the time to kick them and kick them even harder. When, you know, kick them when they're down and let's hope we can get them to stay down. I mean, do people out there that you know really want to just get back to normal, eating the same crap they used to, doing the same things they used to? Or is this, can they be convinced that there might be something better? We could take this and make it into something better than we had before in a lot of different ways. And, you know, especially from our point of view, from what we're doing to these poor creatures. So, you know, I'm reiterating, leadership, you're the only ones out there who can show it because you're the only ones who know the truth and really see it. So we have to do everything we can to promote veganism.
Yes, agreed. Totally agreed. Yeah, it's been definitely the number one thing on my mind, especially because I've been doing these press appearances for Fabulous Vegan. And the number one question I'm getting is, what is the number one tip to go vegan? And it's funny because I've been advocating for veganism for like so many years, as have you. And I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I've basically been saying my number one tip to going vegan is that I promise you, I swear up and down, there is a vegan alternative to what you're used to eating. And all you have to do is figure out what that is. But the truth is, that's not the answer for everyone. I mean, I think like convenience is really important to people. Fabulous Vegan addresses that for sure. Convenience is really important to me. I just have that well-worn vegan muscle. But what do you think is the most, you know, important number one tip for going vegan?
Well, I think it to some extent probably depends on who you're talking to. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're talking to somebody who's asking that, you probably don't really have to go into the reasons. I think we tend to go into the reasons. We talk about, you know, how horrific it is and you know, what harm it's doing. And, you know, maybe you can touch on those. But if somebody's asking, what's your tip to go vegan? They're already thinking about going vegan. So you really do want to stick to the how-tos. And one of the how-tos is, of course, exactly what you're saying, that, you know, don't worry. You know, you'll find the food. But I guess there's just not a single number one. If somebody's really, really focused on health and really wants to do healthy vegan, I'm not sure that's the thing you tell them. You know, like you can tell them that by cutting out meat, you're cutting out probably the unhealthiest food in your diet. And there's so many options and vegetables are so good. You know, you want to go into that health argument. That doesn't mean that's for everybody. Some people want to do it for the animals and they want practical tips and how can they be easy? So like as in everything, you kind of have to know your audience, but you know, no matter what the audience is, you've got the answers because there's so many good reasons to go vegan. How could you even come up with just one?
Yeah. Well, actually I would love to sort of bring it to the listeners. So maybe we can create a graphic this week and just sort of engage you with some answers. Like what's your number one tip on going vegan? And then we can talk about it in one of the future episodes.
Think how powerful that question is though. Like I was just saying, so I think I'll say it again, because why not? People who are asking this aren't thinking why. They, you know, they're past that. They're thinking how. Right. I think this whole movement is moving past why and moving to how, because everybody kind of know, well, not everybody, but a lot of people kind of know this is a good idea. I just don't know how. I don't think I can. Yeah. And so you got to focus on that.
I love that. That actually gave me chills. I really love that so much. And that is, that goes back to my number one sort of hope for 2021 is how to help people get there. How do we do it? So yes, I love that a lot. By the way, when I was writing Fabulous Vegan, my editor, Renee Sudlier at Hachette, is vegan. And after I finished writing the factory farming section, she circled back around to me and was like, we're missing fish. We have to put a section about fish. And I was like, oh my gosh, of course. Like it, as a longtime vegan animal activist, I almost left fish out of the book. And I went back and wrote it, but it made me question, I wrote that like a year and a half ago. Book publishing is a long process. But ever since then, I've been thinking about how I leave that discussion to the, as if it's irrelevant when it is like the most relevant when you think about it. So I'm just so glad that we have Rebecca on the podcast today. Rebecca, aka Becky Jenkins, is an Irish animal advocate and the executive director of the Aquatic Life Institute, an organization with a global reach working to improve aquatic animal lives, especially those farmed and used for food. With ALI, among other things, Becky leads the Global Aquatic Animal Law and Policy Coalition and works closely with the Aquatic Animal Alliance, a coalition of major animal organizations working together for fish. Becky holds a degree in law from Trinity College Dublin, as well as an LLM in animal law from Lewis and Clark Law School, and is an associate fellow at the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics. Becky will be joining Marianne right after this. Greetings, everybody. This is Jasmine Singer, and I wanted to make sure you knew about my new book, The Veg News Guide to Being a Fabulous Vegan. Look good, feel good, and do good in 30 days. Brand new from Hachette in December 2020. Want to be fabulous? Go vegan. Maybe you're interested in it for the food, maybe it's the animals, or maybe climate change has got you thinking. Whatever your reason, maybe you don't quite know where to start. After all, doesn't going vegan mean you have to give up tasty snacks and cool shoes and a sense of humor and your leather couch? Nope, nope, no way. And well, eventually. Covering everything from nutrition, you will get enough protein, promise, to dating, vegans have better sex, it's true. To fitness, you want to lift a car over your head? Sure. I am joining with the team at Veg News to bust all the myths and giving you all the facts about a plant-based lifestyle. With 30 easy recipes to get you started, the Veg News Guide to Being a Fabulous Vegan will help you adopt a vegan lifestyle that's better for you, the animals, and the planet. And what's more fabulous than that? Get your copy today wherever books are sold or go to jasminesinger.com/fabulous. Remember, there's no E on Jasmine. It's jasminesinger.com/fabulous. The Veg News Guide to Being a Fabulous Vegan.
Welcome to our hen house, Becky.
Thank you so much for having me, Marianne.
I am thrilled. I'm thrilled to talk to you. And because apparently we have a history, even though I didn't know about it, but we'll get to that in a little while. Also, I really want to find out about the Aquatic Life Institute because I admit I am not familiar with it at all. It's my understanding that it's pretty new, and I'm assuming our listeners may not be that familiar with it at all as well. So let's just start off with some basics, and then we can get into some more detail. The Aquatic Life Institute, when was it founded, and what is its mission? What does it do?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I think it's a really exciting relatively new organization. And you can definitely be forgiven for not having heard of it yet, and your listeners too. It was founded last year in 2019 by a kind of donor in the animal rights movement who was inspired by the work of Professor Becca Franks at NYU on fish and their capabilities. And our donor our founder, William Bench, who's also actually in New York, was coming from an EA, like an effective altruism point of view, and he couldn't really understand how within the farmed animal rights space there wasn't too much of a focus on aquatic animals and farmed fish. So that was kind of the inspiration behind the Aquatic Life Institute. And then in 2020, we began to expand that team, hiring a couple of staff, and now we have a staff of about 10, and we're hoping to expand more in 2021. And the basic mission is to accelerate activities that positively improve aquatic animal lives. And for us, we mostly focus on farmed fishes and other aquatic animals, since they are the greatest by number.
Yeah, when you get into the numbers involving fish and other aquatic animals, it's just mind-blowing. And it must be hard to understand where to focus. Also, the issues are very complex and involve a lot of science. And so I imagine you definitely have your work cut out for you. But you've also founded an organization? I'm not sure. The Aquatic Animal Alliance, so that you are working with others in this field on some projects. Can you just tell us what that's about as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Aquatic Animal Alliance, I'm glad you brought it up. It's one of the initiatives that I'm most excited about. And it is a project for now of the Aquatic Life Institute. In the future, we may kind of formally incorporate it as a separate entity, but for now, it's under our umbrella. And yeah, we're really, really proud of this accomplishment, even just the kind of founding of it this year. It was inspired very much by the Open Wing Alliance, which some of the listeners might be familiar with. And I can't take too much credit because it really was the work of my colleagues, William and Rocky, before I came on board. They got together some of the biggest kind of groups in animal rights, like Mercy for Animals, the Humane League, Animal Equality, and some smaller but really, really knowledgeable on fish organizations across Europe as well. And so we brought together these organizations to submit feedback to start on, and we can talk more about this later if you're interested. We submitted feedback to a couple of the seafood certifiers on why they should include welfare in their certification schemes and what that welfare should look like. So we're really, really happy about the establishment of that and just how well received our submissions have been this year.
Yeah, it sounds like you have accomplished a lot in a year. As you mentioned, your main focus is fish farming, as well it should be, because it is enormous. But it is also an area of animal agriculture that people may be less familiar with than that involving land animals, even though kind of in which is understandable because there's so many huge problems facing this movement. But at the same time that it has been ignored, it has also grown exponentially. And when you do start worrying about it, you realize that it's absolutely horrific. And so just for those who aren't that familiar with what has been happening in fish farming, can you just give us an overview of the industry and talk a little bit about the welfare of the fish who live in these facilities?
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of been my finding so far as well. And I wasn't too familiar with this industry until a few years back. But as you mentioned, it's a rapidly expanding industry worldwide, including the United States. And at this point, 50% or actually more than 50% of all quote unquote seafood consumed around the world is coming from farmed sources. So there are, of course, a really wide variety of aquatic animals being farmed, from small animals like shrimp to large carnivorous animals like salmon and similar species all around the world. And in many countries, it's being kind of touted as a very sustainable, quote unquote, sustainable food source, an alternative to terrestrial animal products, an alternative to wild caught fish. And it's also being touted as a kind of local community development project in a lot of areas too, where for economic reasons. So we really are kind of up against a lot of proponents of the industry coming from a wide variety of perspectives. In terms of the welfare, it really does vary. You know, there's so many different kinds of fish farming facilities, from a very kind of simple pond set up to a very high-tech facility, such as what we call a RAS facility, a recirculated aquaculture system, which is almost like a CAFO or a CAAP, a concentrated aquatic animal production system, where you have a lot of animals within a very small space and a lot of technology keeping the water at a level that they can survive. We're particularly concerned about these facilities because there's very little enrichment for the animals. They live in a very barren environment, which is very dissimilar to where they would choose to live in the wild. So their environment is one of the areas that we're most concerned with at Aquatic Life Institute. Then there are are, of course, issues around slaughter and a lot of inhumane slaughter practices and a lot of fish being slaughtered without previously having been stunned. That's another focus of a lot of groups, including us.
So fish kind of have even bigger problems for advocates than land animals, in that people don't even understand that they're really conscious, that they feel pain. And actually, also, as you mentioned, some of these facilities are for shrimp and shellfish. There really are questions about that I'm not sure that we can answer yet, about the varying consciousness levels of various animals. So can you just give us an idea of what the current science is? How much do we know about what fish want? And how do we find it out? And is this a field that's growing?
Yes, absolutely a field that's growing, I'm really glad to say, within the animal protection space and within academia and so on. I really have to thank Professor Kathy Hessler. She really took me under her wing and shared a lot of the kind of best available research out there, so I knew where to begin. So in terms of the kind of fin fishes, like you mentioned, there's been ample evidence for a long time that their capacity to feel pain is very similar to terrestrial animals. And even with, as you mentioned, the shrimps, there's a really prolific professor, retired professor now out of Queen's in Belfast, who has dedicated a lot of his career, Robert Elmwood, to the capacities of shrimps and similar animals. So there is, from my perspective and from, I think, at this stage, the vast majority of researchers, there's ample evidence to show that these animals' capacities are actually very similar to land animals. And it's becoming very difficult to dispute that evidence.
It's really interesting. I mean, shrimp kind of surprised me. I didn't know that. What about other? I've just seen people recently getting on board, vegans getting, or ex-vegans, depending on your point of view, getting on board with eating oysters and clams. I don't want to get caught in this question, but I am really curious to know what is the current thought on oysters and clams? Should people feel comfortable eating them?
I mean, for me personally, maybe it's because I'm Irish and I'm European, I kind of apply the precautionary principle. Like, if there's any chance that there's sentience there, any kind of reasonable chance, I'm going to avoid eating them. Also, it's not a food product that I miss personally.
I feel exactly the same way. So I don't think it's Irish. Well, I'm sort of Irish, but or European. It's like, why would you even want to? And anyway, why take the chance?
Yeah,
but if it's absolutely clear that there's nothing wrong, I think that's interesting information. I don't know how you'd ever get there, but all right. I'm sorry I interrupted you. Go on.
Oh, no problem. No, I'm glad we're on the same page with that. Yeah, I mean, we haven't focused on bivalves and oysters and clams and those kinds of animals, I suppose. We haven't focused on them because from our point of view, we couldn't find enough research. And, you know, we're open-minded. If more research comes out and shows, oh, actually, there is sentience there, we will take that on board. And it's also just been an issue of kind of capacity and resources for us, that we really are quite interested in the shrimp and similar animals, but we haven't quite gone there so much with the bivalve farmers.
Yeah, no, they're a bigger problem. There are bigger fish to fry. Oh, sorry. Sorry, that was terrible. And I know this isn't your focus, but can you just like briefly talk about wild-caught fin fish and tell us, or shellfish as well? Can you tell us some of the harms that befall them?
Yeah, I'm really glad that you mentioned wild-caught fish as well, because I think one thing that often I didn't know until a couple of years ago as well is that even farmed fish depend on, in many cases, wild-caught fish. So we're farming a lot of carnivorous fish, such as salmon, trout, and so on. And oftentimes, we're actually feeding them small wild-caught fish. So in many cases, aquaculture systems or fish farm systems are still dependent on wild-capture fisheries. So I just wanted to note that. In terms of wild-caught fish, as you mentioned, it's not our focus. So we have done a little bit of research and a little bit of work on this issue as well. So some of our main concerns there are the capture methods. So we're really concerned about kind of, and I hate to kind of not give a content warning for this, it is a bit graphic, kind of crush injuries and just the suffering involved in many of the commonly used capture methods. Of course, we're also interested in bycatch, like basically catching species that are not the intended target catch. And for many people, you know, they might care about the marine mammals perhaps that get caught, you know, like the dolphin in the tuna case, for example. But we're also really concerned about the fishes and the smaller, less charismatic animals that get caught, get harmed, perhaps die, even though they are not the target species. And then the final thing I'll mention right now is slaughter and stunning. The vast majority of wild caught fish are not stunned before slaughter. They're just left out, you know, to die. It's quite a prolonged death. And there's a lot of evidence that it's really, really involves a lot of suffering. So a lot of the things that go on in the high seas for aquatic animals are things that, you know, we wouldn't dream of in the terrestrial animal context. And then, of course, there is, I'd be kind of remiss not to mention, since it's really been in the media a lot in the last few years, a lot of human rights abuses happening at sea, from minor kind of employment law infringements all the way up to really serious child labor, trafficked labor, and kind of modern day slavery.
Yeah, there have been a lot of news stories about that, and it is appalling. And of course, there's also, and I'm really glad you're not emphasizing it, because it's usually the only topic of focus when discussing this, is the all of the environmental issues and extinction issues. But, you know, it's refreshing in a sort of odd way to talk to somebody who's really focused on how incredibly inhumane it is, because that's usually one of the pieces that gets left out. You mentioned before that you studied under Kathy Hessler at Lewis, and that was at Lewis and Clark Law School. And I know that one of the places that has really caught on to this issue in a very timely way and has really focused strongly on aquatic animals. So can you tell us a little bit about the program and how it influenced you? I'm really curious to know whether fish were a focus before that program.
Yeah, they really weren't so much of a focus for me at all. I mean, I was an ethical vegan and I hadn't eaten fish for many, many years or decades plus. But before I came to Lewis and Clark, that was definitely not my focus. I kind of came into the program thinking I would focus on farmed animals, terrestrial farmed animals, maybe companion animals. I wasn't really sure. How I came onto the fish was that I had the opportunity to attend a talk by Peter Singer, who I'm sure many of the listeners know. And I just went along saying, oh, it's a Peter Singer talk. That'll be really interesting. I assumed he was going to be talking about animal rights, but he was actually talking about effective altruism and altruism more broadly. And that kind of added a new lens in how I wanted to think about what I focused on. So I decided I wanted to focus on animals that were even more neglected, the most neglected animals kind of I could find, and also animals who were suffering in really large numbers. So that made me think a lot about fishes. And then the next semester, I got the lucky opportunity to do the animal law clinic under Kathy Hessler. And that year she was starting the Aquatic Animal Law Initiative with a lot of input from our clinic class. Yeah, and as you mentioned, Kathy really has been a pioneer kind of in the animal law and the animal protection movement in kind of talking about fishes, talking about aquatic animals all the time. You know, whenever there's a conference on factory farming, she was kind of suggesting, well, why don't we have a panel on aquatic animal farming, since it seems kind of bizarre to have a conference about factory farming and then not have the most farmed species, you know, being discussed. And yeah, so they're doing really, really great work at Lewis and Clark. Now it's Kathy Hessler with the current fellow, Amy Wilson. And I'm really lucky that I actually still get to work with them, with Kathy and with Amy, and also with Kelly Lavenda at ALDF on a book project, which is the Aquatic Animal Law textbook. So really excited about that too.
Oh, that is exciting. And it's really nice to hear about an academic advancement, as Kathy put into place at Lewis and Clark, resulting so quickly in, well, I'm not sure that you've changed the industry, but you've changed the advocacy, which is on the way to changing the industry. Sometimes there feels like such a disconnect between academia and the real world. And so I really love seeing that. You know, you mentioned that you're interested in effective altruism. That was one of the things that Peter Singer was talking about. And I feel like there is this unfortunate disconnect between some of the people who are taking an effective altruism approach to advocating for animals and those who are suspicious of it for one reason or another. And I'll focus on one specific issue, and that is like focusing on welfare. You know, so many vegans don't want to focus on welfare. It's seen as kind of a, welfareism is seen as a dirty word, and they don't want to see animals harmed at all. And we all know that no matter how high welfare is in any animal agriculture system, it's still bad. You know, there's nothing that really has high welfare. It's just high compared to other things. And see, so these animals always suffer. And there's always been this difficulty in balancing advocating for welfare and actually holding the line that we shouldn't be doing this at all. Do you think there are ways to approach promoting welfare improvements in which this is less likely to happen, and less likely to promote this idea that it's fine to eat animals?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That is something that
are you because most people hate bringing it up.
No, I'm not talking about this issue. Yeah, I think it's really tricky, and it's definitely something we talk about a lot internally at ALI. And one of the things we have done to kind of hopefully balance out our work is we have launched this kind of public education arm of our work, where our events and also our Qualia project, which is basically a education through photography project, we hope will inspire people to look at these animals as individuals and perhaps question whether or not they should be consuming them at all. So we have one kind of project running that I think is perhaps more on the kind of rights or maybe on the more abolitionist kind of side of things. But that's certainly something we're keeping in mind all the time when we are kind of talking about welfare reforms. We're kind of thinking about, well, what are the kind of inadvertent impacts we could be having? So yeah, no, it is something that keeps me up at night for sure. And I think it's an important kind of, I think it's important to have these conversations and be critical of different strategies. And I do worry that with an effective altruism, for example, that there is perhaps too much of a focus on these corporate campaigns and other campaigns, which are really easy to kind of quantify or measure their impact, and perhaps not enough focus on things such as sanctuaries and media, where the impact we all know can be really, really huge, but it's very difficult to measure. So I do kind of personally come at effective altruism with a very kind of critical approach.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, I feel very much the same way, that this has been a very important development in this movement, but that doesn't mean that everything is exactly right, and that the people who, take the sanctuary issue, which you brought up in the very beginning. Animal advocates who were interested in effective altruism tended to say things like that sanctuaries are a waste of money. This is not, and they really didn't know very much about what sanctuaries were doing. They weren't just caring for animals. They were also reaching the public in important ways. And I think that has developed, and there's more thoughtful analysis of some of the ideas behind effective altruism and how it applies to animal advocacy. So I think that's great. And I love your thoughtful approach to it. One of the things that is definitely welfare related, and it's something you noted before, is that of certifications. I think most of the people who are listening to this podcast are vegan, but they might know people who are very careful about what fish they eat. Most people in the world are not. But you know, there is that subsection of people who look at these serious environmental organizations who seem to do a lot of work certifying seafood, as they call it, in ways that make people very comfortable eating it. So what's the real story here? What are these certifications doing? And you seem to have a critical point of view about them as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the certifications. And I think it could be useful even to the vegans on the line, because they might, you know, have friends or family who'll say, well, I only eat certified fishes, or I only eat certified seafood. So that's environmentally friendly. That's humane. One of the main problems that we're concerned with is, at this point, there really is little to no welfare consideration in these certification schemes. So it has largely focused on things like quote unquote, like fish stock depletion and things like bycatch. Slowly, the certifiers are beginning to introduce animal welfare standards. That's one of the reasons ALI exists is because our friend really saw that that was beginning to happen and was really concerned that it was going to be kind of a greenwashing or humane washing where perhaps there might be one requirement such as stunning before slaughter and then a seafood product, quote unquote seafood product, could be labeled humane. And we don't think that goes far enough at all, as you said before. So that's kind of the impetus that we are trying to encourage these certifiers to take the absolute highest welfare standards that they're willing to. And we've actually had a bit of success with that through the Alliance already. One of the biggest certifiers that represents about 1% of the world seafood industry has already kind of responded to our recommendations and has increased their welfare recommendations or their draft welfare recommendations. But I mean, the main takeaway I would want for folks is that at this point, these labels really only focus on environmental standards. And there's actually a lot of environmental groups and even some fish vets I've spoken to who don't even think their environmental standards go far enough. And so I would have a lot of caution and criticism about how much weight I put in those certification schemes at this point in time.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And because I think one of the things that intimidates people about discussing these issues is that they're complicated and, you know, all these different standards and the environmental issues can be very complex. And if we do get in a position of criticizing these standards, apparently they're pretty damn easy to criticize on welfare grounds because they don't even really talk about them.
Yeah, yeah. At this point, they really don't. But they are, a lot of them, a lot of the really big ones this year and next year are drafting their first ever welfare standard. So we thought this was a really big opportunity not to be missed, to really push them that these standards have to actually impact fish lives. That's one of the reasons we're really focusing on environmental enrichment because, you know, and I hate to talk about too much about slaughter because I know that it can be triggering, so a bit of a content warning, but I won't get too much into it. But obviously slaughter, there's a lot of suffering involved, but it is a very short duration, hopefully in an ideal case. But what about the fish's whole life up to that point where they live in very, very barren conditions? I learned just this year that sturgeon, for example, can live 10 plus years in confinement. And just the thought of these animals living in a very, very barren condition with very little in terms of social and physical sensory enrichment. So we're really pushing the certifiers to think not just about the slaughter methods, but the fish's whole life up until that point.
Yeah, sturgeon, is that because they can take the eggs? I mean, sturgeon are for caviar, right? Do they live so long because they're basically egg-laying machines, like egg-laying hens?
Yeah, yeah. It's really similar to that. It's pretty heartbreaking industry, honestly. You know, if viewers feel kind of resourced enough to look into the farming, it really can be quite horrifying.
Yeah, I had never thought of that. Boy, you know, no matter how long you do this, you find out new horrors every day. What can you tell us? Any other fish stories? Maybe some good ones. Talk about, like, we now know that fish can feel pain, but presumably their lives are a lot more complicated than that. What are some of your favorite stories about what fish can do, or what shows us that they are very cool animals?
Yeah, absolutely. So like on the academic level, I really do encourage listeners to check out the work of Professor Becca Franks.
And she has been on the podcast, by the way. I don't remember the episode number, but check that out.
Yeah, folks should really go and listen to that one. What I like about her work is she focuses on their capacity to have pleasurable and positive experiences, just like we do, right? It's not all, you know, reducing their suffering isn't enough. We also want them to have a life which is kind of enjoyable. And I've been really interested in the research that's come out in recent years that just focuses on fish's relationships with one another and how they play and different things that they enjoy, like rubbing themselves off different structures. And like, I've been really happy to learn more about their capacity for joy and pleasure, you know, as all animals have. In terms of in my own life, I don't live with any aquatic animals at the moment, but my colleague, and I don't think she'll mind me mentioning this, at Aquatic Life Institute, Rocky has a couple of rescued aquatic animals. So she's got some hermit crabs who are pretty, you know, they keep to themselves naturally. And she's got a beautiful fish, I believe an Oscar fish called Samantha. And Samantha lives in a very large tank. She is a rescue. I won't talk too much about where she comes from, but she lives in a very large and obviously very beautifully enriched tank. And even for me, I was surprised coming into it that when I would have like Zoom calls, you know, talking about our strategy and fundraising and our social media, whatever we're talking about, like, you know, ALI shop talk, Samantha would come over to the tank and be interested in, you know, Rocky's conversation with me. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, she's so interested. And when people come into the room, you know, she will swim over to that end of the tank. Apparently, I think she likes to eat blueberries, if I'm not mistaken. So it's been really nice to kind of get to know from a distance this one fish, you know, who is eaten in some cultures, absolutely, but is kind of living her best life, you know, that's possible still in captivity. So that's probably my favorite fish story I have.
Yeah. That is lovely. And I also know someone, Marisa Miller Wolfson, who's been on the podcast, and she has a son who is fascinated by fish, and she also has rescued fish who live very, very good lives, and you know, would not have a life otherwise if they were not rescued. And I think it's such a privilege to be able to have fish in your house and most people have to or should feel guilty about it, but it brings up this conundrum of how do we get to know these animals without ever being near them, and yet being near them can be so dangerous for them. So that is one good solution. Well, it's a solution we would want to disappear because we don't want any animals to have to be rescued. But as long as they do have to be rescued, it's a good solution. You know, it brings up the question of this whole project that you have, as you mentioned, the Aqualia Project, and I'm sure other work you do, that tries to get people to understand that fish are sentient and intelligent and emotional. But bottom line, people know that about pigs and cows and still act horrifically to them. But it is an important first step, understanding that these are real animals. You still see on, you know, on TV shows or whatever, like some cute little piece about some guy going fishing with his kids and as if it's just a joke. So do you have hope that we can change people's minds about fish to catch up with the science?
Yeah, it's really tricky. And, you know, even in some cultures and in some languages, you know, the word for fish or for quote unquote seafood is like fruit of the sea, right? Basically. And so yeah. I think we have a long way to go. And as you mentioned, even with pigs and so on, people often know that they're sentient, but still don't change their behavior. So I do think we have a long way to go. I do think sanctuaries can play a role in that. We're kind of going to be focusing a little bit more on sanctuaries and rescued fish in the future, because I think it's really hard to replicate that relationship or that experience with one individual. I do think we have our work cut out for us. We're trying to, with the Aqualia Project and with our social media as well, just kind of get people interested in fishes, like interesting facts about them, not always doom and gloom, to kind of, yeah, just kind of grow that interest and appreciation for these kind of like fascinating and important animals. But yeah, we really do have our work cut out for us. I think kind of like humane education is something I often think about as well. And I think it's such an important development within our movement, this kind of developing empathy and compassion in kids as young as possible. And I really hope that humane educators will incorporate aquatic animals into their programming.
Yeah, I think as the industry has become so much huger and your work and others starts to focus on fish, there's a lot of hope that will happen. Because as with the little boy I was talking about, I think children are fascinated by fish by and large because they are so different than us. It's the same way that they're fascinated about dinosaurs. You know, it's just they're so extraordinary. So I think there's a lot of hope that if you just stop children from being disinformed at a very young age, that there's just a natural, maybe not the same kind of affinity as for land animals, but a natural interest. And I mentioned in the beginning that we had history. And before I let you go, I really want you to tell this story because I love it so much. It makes me so happy. So tell us about your history with our hen house.
Yeah. So I was in law school in Ireland, in Trinity College, Dublin. And I was kind of just lost, didn't know what I wanted to do with my education, with my career, all of these things. And I'd been vegetarian and kind of into animal activism a little bit for many years, but I had just gone vegan in my, I think, third year of law school. And that was when I was like searching for podcasts. I wanted to learn more. Something about going vegan from vegetarian made me just so much more committed and invested in the cause. So I found Our Hen House and I started listening to it. And then I started kind of searching about, oh, well, I wonder if I can kind of merge the law and the animal stuff. Like Marianne seems to be doing that and has been for many decades. And so I found out about, I think, the Animal Legal Defense Fund in the sense for Animal Law Studies at Lewis and Clark around the same time that I found out about Our Hen House. And when I came to Our Hen House, you know, it had been around for quite some time. So I was like, you know, really listening to a lot of episodes. And at the time, I didn't really know any vegans. I didn't really know many animal activists. So it was a little bit of a lonely kind of experience. And so listening to Our Hen House really kind of emboldened me to like keep at it, to learn more, and to apply for the Animal Law LLM program. And luckily, I got accepted. I moved to Portland, Oregon, after a little bit of a kind of gap year working in politics, which was great also. Moved to Portland, Oregon, got my LLM in animal law. And so I wouldn't have come to the Fishes if it weren't for Our Hen House, for you and Jasmine's work. And also I wouldn't have met my now fiance, who I met through the program at Lewis and Clark, who you also know. And I also, maybe even more important than my fiance, though he won't like to hear that, is my dog, Piggy, who is a rescue from the Portland area, from a local nonprofit there called One Tail at a Time PDX, which was also started by a Lewis and Clark alum. So I really have, you know, you and Jasmine to thank in large part for ending up doing this kind of work full time, meeting my future husband and also meeting my soulmate dog.
Wow, I feel like I could just quit right now. That's like my favorite story anybody has ever told me. And am I allowed to mention who we are talking about? He won't be mad at me. I mean, of course,
he'll love it.
Oh, Peter. And he was just on the podcast too. Peter Brand, who is one of my favorite people on the planet. You have to be very, very nice to him for your whole life, as I'm sure you will be. You also sound like you could be one of my favorite people on the planet, but I don't know you. I know Peter, and he's just a love. And his new book, he was on the podcast about his new book, Indefensible. And it's so good, and everybody has to read it. And this is my best ending to an interview I've ever had in my life.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad that we got to talk about it a little bit.
Thank you so much for joining us, Becky. This has really been great.
Thank you so much, Marianne. It's such a pleasure. It really was.
If you like what you're listening to, and I hope you do, then please consider taking a minute out of your day today to leave us a friendly review. You can do it on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or Stitcher or on Facebook or wherever you listen to podcasts or wherever you're listening to this. The more we get out there, the more Our Hen House will be in front of people's eyeballs when they're putting in search terms in their podcasts, and the more we could join forces together to elevate the voices of the animals and change the world for them. So thank you so much in advance for leaving us a friendly review.
Anxieties are rising. Our first story is from Japan. Cash for cages? Japan probes alleged bribery from chicken industry. It says that they're specifically talking about the egg industry, though this article from The Guardian calls it the chicken industry, which I'm sure has its problems of its own. But this is a pretty interesting story. Apparently, the policy in Japan is pretty much all battery cages all the time. They have not made any shifts at all. And then the World Organization for Animal Health, the abbreviation is OIE because it's in French, issued this new draft guidance. And of course, Japan is a member, as are most countries, many, many countries, for egg producers, advising against battery cages and instead going for, you know, these larger and quote unquote more comfortable nest boxes and perches, the kind of cages that have been implemented widely in the EU, I mean, are required in the EU. And I'm not sure they've been implemented everywhere, probably not, but they are required now in the EU. And the World Organization for Animal Health was saying, you know, everybody should do this. Japan was full of egg producers who were not terribly pleased. And Takamori Yoshikawa, who was the agriculture minister until September 2019, is alleged I don't know whether it was in response to this, but he is alleged, hasn't admitted, to have accepted 5 million yen. That's 36,000 pounds, and that's as far as I can find it. You'll have to figure it out in your own cash yourself. But it's a lot of money, and that's in undeclared donations from this former representative of a leading egg producer in Hiroshima Prefecture. Okay, so what happened after that? Interestingly, in January 2019, the government then said it opposed this draft from the OIE on the grounds that the arrangements for keeping poultry would increase the number of cracked and dirty eggs. Well, God forbid, you know, let's cram them into cages so we don't have any cracked eggs, and would lead to a higher death rate among chickens, which is always the claim. And, you know, the problems with larger cages are huge, huge. Are they worse than the problems with battery cages? Do we really have to decide this, people? Just stop eating eggs anyway. The OIE then watered down its guidance. It vehemently denies that it was in response to any one issue. But, you know, the fact that Japan was probably campaigning against it probably didn't hurt. And saying that the use of nest boxes and perches was desirable and would not be a requirement. Yeah, well, money talks, doesn't it? All over the world. Animal Rights Center Japan offered its opinion that prolonging the suffering of chickens was not the right way to go, and instead the industry should work with governments and lawmakers to improve animal welfare. Well, there's an idea. There's an idea. But, you know, apparently this happens all over the world. Is that reassuring that bad things happen everywhere? Can't we just have a policy that good things will happen everywhere? Anyway, this is a great article. This is from Patriot Post, and it's by one R. Emmett Terrell, How Joe Biden Can Revive Liberalism. This is, of course, an extremely conservative, anti-liberal publication. So we're being sarcastic here. He first points out, it's Emmett. I assume he is the appropriate pronoun. He would be so annoyed to hear me say that, you know, Joe doesn't want to call himself a radical or even progressive. Obviously, the crazy people like Crazy Bernie and Congress girl Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez don't want to call him moderate. So he will probably adopt the term liberal. But, you know, liberals create projects, according to this article, have all been tried, and frequently they have failed. His first example is Social Security, which, you know, I don't think most people tend to think that Social Security is a failure. But he thinks, you know, they make that evaluation without having looked at how much better it would have been if we used private insurance. So starting with the war on poverty, it's all been a failure. Anti-poverty initiatives have cost people a fortune, and still people are living in poverty. Okay, there's proof that what we did was a failure. I guess everybody would be rich if we had the war on poverty. Liberals failed on racism. They've started out okay, but then once they adopted affirmative action, you know, it made racial discrimination so much worse. Anyway, the point I'm getting to is he then follows up all of these evaluations with what new issue should Joe Biden and other quote-unquote clueless liberals adopt to keep them out of trouble? His advice is animals. How about working for a Bill of Rights campaign for household pets, even goldfish, even ant colonies? Democrats did it for angry women. You succeeded for the transgendered. How about Spot, the Cocker Spaniel? Does he not know that there actually is an animal rights movement, I wonder? Oh, no, he does. We know that there is an animal rights movement and that it has made amazing strides. Exploit it. God, I wish he would. Don't you just wish he would? Just the other day, I heard a woman, obviously a feminist, lecturing a dog walker on some infraction regarding his, obviously a white male, dog's leash. Well, that establishes everything that we should know. He heard an argument. He's suggesting that Joe Biden should revive liberalism. You know, I'm actually with you. And you can attract the animal rights fanatics, which he abbreviates as ARFs, would attract me. And he wants to be invited into the White House to put in charge of outreach for stray dogs. Oh, these people. Like, I can't, like, it's hard to even make fun of them anymore. I'm so worn out. But I'll try. For your sakes, I'll try. In elections and in life, we need the cowboy code of ethics. This is from Amanda Radke, writing for Beef Magazine. And she starts off with the trigger warning, which is, you know, already I'm cautious. How is she going to trigger me? she talks about all the horrible things that she has heard from people over the years when she has been honest and written from the heart. One of the earliest was she led a walkout from a Carrie Underwood concert at National Future Farmers of America convention because Carrie supports the Humane Society of the United States. Yeah, Amanda's obviously been using her time well for a long time. So she's gotten all this nasty hate mail, which, you know, some of it does sound like it was pretty nasty, but, you know, welcome to the world. There have been so many cases of assault on my character, my livelihood, and my safety in between these cases. So why do it? Because there are a few things that guide me to write and write honestly from the heart. This is the Cowboy Code of Ethics. Well, first of all, before she gets to that, there's the Ten Commandments and the Bible. Nothing like waving the Bible at everybody. Others have done that of late. Acting like you represent God, always a charming approach. And then she has talked about politics and has gotten in trouble. And, you know, I could have spent the last month taking a close look at Biden's potential administration. However, I could spend equally as much time covering the evidence of fraud in this election and walking us through the various pieces of litigation that are being presented in the courts. I guess she wrote this before they all lost. Trump's team says the president still has a few pathways to securing a win in his favor. No, Amanda, give it up. I think she's kind of facing the fact on that. So now she's yanking out the Cowboy Code of Ethics. And this code provides country folks with guiding principles to live by. I don't know why this is just for country folks. And to tell you the truth, you know, they're all great. Well, one of them I don't understand, but they're all great. I'll read them to you. But my point here is, like, how dare you drag out like these the first one is do what is right. Do what is right. You think you are the person who represents what is right because you're a cowboy and that puts you above other people. Are you joking? Like, these are just like normal rules for good behavior. And she thinks it's all about her and her group of cowboys, whoever they are in this day and age. Or I'll just read them. Do what is right. There's a controversial statement. Live each day with courage. Oh, Amanda, aren't you fabulous? You're so courageous. Blogging your little heart out and getting criticized. Take pride in your work. Well, that, you know, that would be a good idea, depending on what kind of work you're doing and whether it's worthy of pride. Finish what you start. Oh, there's a controversial one. Do what has to be done. Oh, another like really great, like imagine that. Be tough, but fair. Okay. When you make a promise, keep it. Wow. This is really impressive. Amanda believes in keeping promises. And of course, she does it all the time. Ride for the brand. Well, that's the one I don't understand. Talk less and say more. Well, if you would talk less, I would be very pleased. Remember that some things aren't for sale. Yeah. Know where to draw the line. Well, you know, maybe some of these people should work a little harder at knowing where to draw the line, like drawing it on the other side of cruelty. And the other side of viciousness and the other side of destroying our world. But no, they know where to draw the line and it ain't where I would draw it. And that's it for this week's Rising Anxieties.
Well, that's it for this week's show. As always, if you like the podcast and you're able in these difficult times, you can support us by joining our flock at ourhenhouse.org/donate for $10 a month or $100 a year. Or you can make whatever donation you're comfortable with. Another great way to support us is to leave a fabulous review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to podcasts, or like us on Facebook. You could also leave us a review there or follow us on Twitter or Instagram at Our Hen House. If you shop on Amazon, you can use Amazon Smile using Our Hen House as your favorite charity. And of course, tell your friends about us. If you're one of our listeners who already supports us, thank you so much. And thank you to my co-host, Marianne Sullivan, and to Jen Riley for her work in producing this podcast, and to composer Michael Herron for the music. Thanks to Podcast Haven for their work editing this podcast, and to our production assistant, Jocelyn Martinez. We will be back next week with a brand new show, so don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're a Flock member, remember to check your email or the Flock Facebook group on Tuesday for your bonus content, and join us on Fridays for Flock Fridays, where we do some really cool Zooms that you'll want to join. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Jasmine Singer, and be safe out there. Social distance, stay home, wash your hands, and listen to podcasts.